Must have some great stories yourself, and you're very knowledgeable. You got a lot of.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 22 days into the month of September. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Spoken Word Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have episode 30 of the Disability History Association's podcast, titled The Real Origin of Race Point Writing. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up now is an episode of the Disability History Association podcast, titled The Real Origins of Race Point Writing. That's up now.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Disability History Association podcast. I'm Caroline Leifers.
And I'm Kelsey Henry.
And it is our pleasure today to be talking with Philippa Campsey. Philippa recently published a brilliant article in Disability Studies Quarterly entitled, if I can anglicize his name, Charles Barbier or Charles Barbier, A Hidden Story, which substantially revises our understanding of the origins of raised point writing. Philippa, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Delighted to be here.
We have a lot to talk about today, but we want to start by celebrating the fact that you are an independent scholar, since I think independent scholars don't get nearly as much recognition as they should. How does historical scholarship fit into your life?
Well, my undergraduate degree was actually in history. I went to Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, and I studied history and biology and did an undergraduate thesis in history of science. So there is a link there. I then worked in publishing, and I went back to university to do a master's degree in urban planning as a mature student, and even became an adjunct professor in the Department of Geography and Planning at the University of Toronto. And the rest of my career was a freelance researcher, writer, and editor. But I've done a number of historical, a lot of my research was historical, even for urban planning, looking into policy histories and things like that. I've always had an interest in how things developed to the point where they are now. I also have a fascination with France. I spent a year in France going to university. And since 2010, my husband is Norman Ball. He's a historian of technology. We try to get to Paris once a year when travel was still possible. And so in 2010, we started a blog called Parisian Fields, where we explore all kinds of little stories that we find, many of them historical stories. So history has always been part of my life, but I'm new to disability history because of this story. I just wanted to find out more about a particular person.
I don't know if Caroline, you mentioned this already, but both of us have a background in the history of science and medicine. So we're both sort of familiar with the history of science, history of medicine to disability history pipeline. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that because I feel like it's a fairly common drift between those two fields. So it's really exciting to learn a little bit more about how that was your transit into disability history. But let's dig into thinking about and talking about your article together. So your article rewrites kind of common understandings of the origins of Braille, the Braille writing system or reading system, in really exciting ways. And I'm wondering if you can give us the SparkNotes, Cole's Notes version of the story that has been circulating more widely over the last 60 or so years. What's the usual narrative that's told?
Well, I'm going to start with Once Upon a Time, because so many of these stories are actually written for children. It's surprising how many children's books focus on Louis Braille. There are some for adults, but I would say they're far outnumbered by children's books. And the story in those and most books, Once Upon a Time, there's a little boy called Louis Braille. Born in 1809. He loses his sight as a result of an accident and then an infection when he's about 3 years old. However, he's a very bright little boy, and he gets the opportunity to go to a special school for blind students in Paris. He comes from a village that's to the east of Paris. He does very well at the school, and when he's about 12 years old, he starts at the school when he's about nine, I think, when he's about 12 years old, a military officer comes to the school to demonstrate a method of writing that he has developed to allow soldiers to communicate at night on the battlefield without lighting a lamp that might betray their position. This method works quite well. It's very simple, but it's a bit cumbersome. It takes a lot of space on the page. It's just letters or sounds. There's no punctuation. There's no capitalization. You can't use it for numbers or arithmetical symbols or music or all of the other things that the students want to do with it, but they can at least use it to communicate amongst themselves and to take notes. Louis, being a bit of a child prodigy, points out these errors to Barbier, and Barbier is not particularly receptive to them. So Louis, alone and unaided all by his little self, he goes and creates the system that we now use around the world today. End of story.
Thank you so much for walking us through that. And I think it's so fascinating what you were saying about how the history of Braille's life story has typically been delivered and framed for children, which does kind of influence the more fairy tale, like hagiographic impulses.
With the obligatory villain provided Charles Barbier always gets to play the villain.
Right.
I've even seen a movie that they made of it, and he's wearing this ridiculous uniform that looks like something out of the Nutcracker. And he's really being quite offensive to Louis Braille, saying, you can't be expected to do this and you can't be expected to do that, which is, as we will see, complete fiction.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning in the article kind of this David and Goliath archetype.
Yes. So the little boy was portrayed as sort of this little golden-haired child and things like that, and there's the evil Barbier in his uniform. No, people really play it up.
Well, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you became interested in this history. I can imagine if you encounter this particular framing of the relationship between Barbier and Braille, and as you start doing more archival research, you recognize the distortions or the peculiarities in the way that the story has been spun. I can imagine that really piqued your interest as a historian. And I know that we're going to rewrite a lot of the story that you told us throughout this podcast conversation today. But I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about how you became so fascinated in this history to begin with. Were you very intentionally searching for the origins of raised point writing, or did the story kind of just find you by accident?
Oh, definitely the story found me. As I say, I'm a newcomer to disability history, but we were in Paris when it was December 2016, and my husband, as I mentioned, my husband Norman Ball is a historian of technology, and he had become very, very interested in the technology associated with communication with and among blind people. There's a wonderful museum in Paris, the Museum of Blindness, which is housed in the building. It's called the Association Valentin Aoui. And it's a training center for adult blind people, and it's right beside the school, the regular day school for school-aged children, which is now known as the Institut National des Jeunes Aveugles, which means the National Institute for Young Blind People. So my husband was there, and he was absolutely absorbed in looking at all these amazing machines that they have, all kinds of different designs of machines to write in Braille, some of which claimed that they could write in both Braille and regular type and all kinds of things. Anyway, so I'm there and I pick up a book, a French book by a guy called Pierre-Henri, La vie et l'œuvre de Louis Braille. So the life and work of Louis Braille. I start reading it. Within a few pages, I encounter this guy, Charles Barbier. I'd never heard of him before. But I thought, well, no, that's interesting, because I didn't know much about Braille, and I didn't know that he wasn't the one who had the original idea to communicate with raised dots. I assumed that that was his idea. And the idea to communicate with raised dots in a way that did not attempt to reproduce the shapes of the letters of the alphabet. And he did not invent the tools for doing it. The blunt punch that you use and the framework for creating these letters. That was Barbier. I've never heard of this guy. So I go to the curator of the museum, her name's Noël Roy, and say, what do you know about Barbier? And she sort of looks at me, says, are you interested? And I think, I guess so. And she said, well, in 2001, members of his family gave us a whole bunch of his papers. She said, I've cataloged them, but nobody's really read them. And I thought, okay, I'm here. I don't see anybody else lining up to do this. So I said, sure, I'll take a look. I had no idea what was going to be in them. I don't even know quite what I planned to do. I just thought the book showed that there wasn't much known about him. And I thought, well, I can probably fill in some gaps here. I can probably find out a bit more about him. Maybe I can, you know, flesh out the Wikipedia article or something like that. I had modest ambitions. But over time, I read the books. There were books in there. There were letters in there. And also the school, the Institut National des Jeunes Aveugles, in its library, there are a lot more letters. There were letters written by Barbier to the school. And in the box, there were letters written to Barbier that were in his possession when he died. And I also found some more materials at the Museum of Louis Braille in Couffre, in his birthplace. So that's another good source of information. And it was only gradually that I realized, wait a second, the story's wrong. You've got it all wrong, guys. He clearly invented his method. He didn't invent it for the military. He invented it for blind people. All sorts of things that happen in the story don't happen in real life. I never expected that I was going to sort of say, wait a second, just about everything in that story is wrong and we need to rethink it.
Well, this is incredible. And I'm really looking forward to unpacking all of the different pieces of the story that you were able to rewrite for us. Let's start with a little bit of setting the scene, the background. Mm-hmm. The late 18th and early 19th centuries were already kind of a period of change for blind people in France, even before Barbier shows up on the scene. So can you tell us a little bit about the revolution in attitudes and education that was already starting to happen?
Yeah, so France is among the first places that offers a formal education to blind people. The name that I mentioned before, Valentin Haüy, took me a while to learn how to say that name. It's an unusual name. He was the first person that we know of, who is commonly accepted to be the first person who thought, wait a second, you know, we are sort of wasting the lives of blind people. Before he started his school, if you were blind, you were okay if you had a wealthy family because they could support you and get people to read to you. And some wealthy blind people did become quite literate simply by having somebody read to them all the time. But otherwise, most people, there was very little opportunity to learn any skills, to become independent, to earn a living. And most of them lived in abject poverty. It was quite dreadful. And Valentin Haüy was scandalized at the mistreatment of them. People made fun of them and bullied them, and it was awful. And many of them had to beg on the streets. So starting with one student and expanding to create a school, Valentin Haüy opened the school before the French Revolution, so early in the 1780s. And it was actually sort of favored by royalty and so forth. And he created a way to teach students to read by making raised letters. So thick paper, and you needed a very special printing press to do this, to raise these letters. And they were cursive letters, and the students had to, not even block letters, but cursive letters the students had to trace. The books took up an enormous amount of space and were very hard to produce. And if the students learned to read with them, that was one thing, but learning to write was, they couldn't produce them for themselves. Some of them, including Louis Braille, learned how to write in a way that sighted people could read, but they couldn't write in a way that other blind people could read. That school closed during the French Revolution. The students were transferred to a hospital. And that was a very dark period. They weren't getting any kind of education. They may have had some rudimentary skills training at that point. And throughout that period, so not just the revolution, but also the Napoleonic period, the school was reestablished at about the same time that the monarchy was reestablished. So 1815 is Waterloo. Napoleon moves off the stage finally. and the monarchy is reestablished. And this had been a royal institution, so it is reestablished in about 1816.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'd love to hear a little bit more about Charles Barbier, or Charles Barbier, his background and his early work on alternative writing systems.
He was born in Valenciennes, which is in the eastern part of France, minor aristocracy. He and two of his brothers go into the military. The officers in the military were all members of the aristocracy. He spent about 8 years in the military, but when the revolution comes, you don't want to be in the king's army. And so he left. They estimate that about half of the officers in what had been the royal army left the country. A lot of them went elsewhere in Europe or to England, but Barbier went to the United States. And at first I wondered why, and then I discovered he had a brother there. One of his brothers, another military guy, had gone there. So he goes to the States in 1792, and he first spends time with his brother in Baltimore, and then he moves to Kentucky. There are a couple of French communities in Kentucky. He earns a living teaching French, but also teaching and practicing surveying, which is something that he would have learned as an artillery officer. He may have been in the United States for as long as 10 years. I don't know the year he came back. I have not yet been able to figure out exactly when he returned, but there was an amnesty for the people who had immigrated during the revolution. Napoleon proclaimed an amnesty. So he was free to come back, but he had made enough money through, as far as I can tell, investing in land in Kentucky, that he was now quite independently, he was independent. He was, I don't know about independently wealthy, but he was independent. He didn't have to work for his living when he came back, and he certainly did not rejoin the army. People often place him in Napoleon's army, but he did not rejoin the army. He followed his own passion, and his passion was alternative methods of writing. He was fascinated by them. And the first thing he created that was published, I guess, was a form of shorthand. Very complicated. I have a photocopy of the book, and there is absolutely no way I can make head or tail of it. I've tried. It's just far too hard. It's a very complicated method of shorthand. And there were already plenty of other methods out there that people were using. I mean, during the revolution, the records of the debates were taken in shorthand. There were other competing ones that were very well established. But the end of the book contains a very interesting little appendix in which he's moving in the direction of simplified writing. And in this appendix, he has created what he calls écriture coupée, which means writing with cuts. And the idea was that if you were somewhere and you didn't have access to pen and ink, you could still make a note on paper using a knife. And of course, before, in the days before ballpoints and fountain pens and things like that, if you wanted to write, you had to have a pen and a bottle of ink. You couldn't, it was something that you might not have if you were out in the field somewhere or traveling. So he creates this idea of écriture coupée. You make a fold in the paper, and then your cuts are oriented in relation to that line that has been created by the fold. So you could, in fact, take a note of something important and read it back to yourself if you use this method. And this sort of sends him in a different direction. So in 1815, 6 years later, so the book, that the shorthand came out in 1809. In 1815, he publishes the book on which everything else is based. They have a copy of it in the library, but you can read it yourself on Google Books. It's out there now. It's got about 30 pages of text and 12 diagrams. And it presents 12 different forms of writing for a range of purposes. The very earliest forms are very simple forms of writing that are designed to for people to use if they have no experience of writing and no literacy, and they can try this as a very simplified way of capturing their thoughts on paper. At the very end of the book, there's some very complicated ones which are intended for sort of a form of cryptography that could be used by diplomats to write secret messages. One of them looks like a musical notation on a stave, five lines and these little dots, but the dots are placed and connected in a certain way that forms the message. And in about the middle is one that involves raised points. The introduction to the book makes it very, very clear this is for blind people to use. They can read it by touch. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you think, what is the audience for stuff that can be read by touch? There's maybe a few officers in the field, and then there's a whole bunch of blind people. I mean, there's a much bigger market for this. Why anybody would ever think that, that it was invented for the military. But no, it was invented clearly and specifically for blind people. He'd done a little testing, but it was kind of speculative. I don't know that he was absolutely sure that it would work, but he thought it was worth a try. And the illustration includes one of the tools required for producing these dots. So he had also invented the particular equipment that was necessary. And so this little 1815 book is sort of where it all starts in the story.
Fascinating. I love hearing about the materiality, like the technology, the knives, the tools to make the razor. Yeah. All of this is so fascinating.
Yeah, Philippa, thank you so much for giving us a really comprehensive sort of genealogy of the way RBA's thinking and actually production of different kinds of alternative writing systems, how they evolved over time. One thing that we're both really curious about, and we know our listeners would love to know more about, why was Barbier so interested in creating alternative writing systems in the first place, and especially a phonetic system of alternative writing? And what did that have to do with his intended audience?
Well, the book had many intended audiences, but the remainder of Barbier's life shows that what he really, really was trying to accomplish was universal education. He actually, if you'd asked him how he saw himself, he might have said it, he was an inventor. He might have said, I'm an educational reformer, or a would-be educational reformer. And the introduction to the book is a bit of a manifesto. He felt very strongly that it took far too long to teach people to read. And if you have to work for your living, either on a farm or as an artisan or in a shop in a city, you don't have that kind of time. You can't spend years and years and years of your life learning how to write and read. So most of them didn't. Literacy levels were very low. And writing is very difficult. And spelling is worse. Spelling is impossible. And he felt that part of the problem, and this gets to the sort of his idea about writing phonetically. He said, part of the problem is our alphabet. It's full of holes, but it's also redundant. So you can create the same sound with more than one letter. So the sound produced by a K can also in some cases be produced by a C or a Q. So there's redundancy in it, but there's also missing letters. So certain letters, you have to have combinations of letters to produce a certain sound, such as, you know, CH or SH. You have to have the two letters in order to represent the sound. He said, the ideal alphabet would have one letter for each sound, no more, no less. One sound per letter. Very simple. So he felt that things had become overcomplicated, and he wanted to radically simplify things so that, I don't think he was thinking that, that the people necessarily needed to learn reading to the point where they could, you know, read Molière or anything like that. He just felt that in their work, they need to be able to capture their thoughts, and they need to be able to transmit their thoughts to other workers, to their family members, on paper. And there had to be a simpler way to do this than the one that they had at the time. So he created the early methods in that book were created very specifically to be the simplest possible form of writing that he could come up with. So you didn't have to, I mean, when you think of the writing at the time and reading his letters, I got to see lots of it. It's very complicated. It's very difficult. Manipulating a pen is difficult. So he wanted to radically simplify the way in which people who didn't have access to formal education could at least note down things for themselves, for others, for posterity. And he thought, yeah, that won't take them too long to learn. They don't have to give up a lot of work time to do this.
Thank you so much for that. I'm wondering, how do these insights about Barbier's history and kind of his motivations for developing an alternative writing system, which, as you just described, primarily was intended for blind people, but also was in service of this larger goal of universal education. How do these insights change our understanding of Braille's origins and his motivations? And as I'm talking, I'm curious about if Braille had any sort of a shared interest in universal education, or if that wasn't a part of Braille's story at all.
That's a very good question. I don't think he did, but I haven't read all of Barbier's correspondence. I haven't read all of Braille, so I couldn't really comment on that. What I did find interesting and a bit surprising is that Barbier's attitude towards the school was not what you might expect. He didn't see the students at the school as his ultimate audience. Yes, they were blind students, but he thought, relative to the people I'm really trying to reach, they're privileged. They're in a school. They've got years to learn all these skills in a school. The people he really wants to reach are the people who don't have formal education. His idea was that, in fact, the students would learn the method and teach it to other people. They would go out there and teach other people. One of the expressions that turns up a lot in his letters is either les aveugles de dehors or les ouvriers de dehors, which means either the blind people outside the school or workers outside the school. Those were the people he wanted to reach. He even had the idea that the students shouldn't really bother learning this until they were just about to graduate. And then they would learn it just before they graduated. And he donated hundreds of sets of equipment, which he would give to them. And then they could take it out and teach it to other people. A completely unrealistic and utopian idea, because, of course, how are they going to earn their living doing that? They have been trained to earn their living either as musical performers or skilled tradespeople or something of the sort. They weren't actually being trained to be teachers. So it's kind of, he had this funny idea that the school was going to be a clearinghouse for his simplified method of education, and that the students, and it seems he had every confidence that the students were capable of doing this, we're just going to take it out and teach it to everybody else. He had no hesitation in thinking that they could do that, but that's not actually what the school was formed to do. So you can see how he butted heads with the administration.
Did he invest his own money in getting all of these sets created? Did he have a workshop going in his attic? I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about how these were actually generated? Right.
There was a set that he displayed. They often had kind of expositions of new inventions. And at one of those, he says he displays his tools, and they were made by a blind person. At this point, Barbier is not living in Paris. He's living in Versailles, and so is this other person who creates the tools. And the three, there were three tools originally. Eventually, they were condensed to two. There was something called the tablette, which was basically the support on which you would put the paper, and it had grooves in it that would allow you to press in and create these dots. And then there's the punch that you use to create the dots. And then a thing called a guide main, which is just a guide, to make sure that the dots lined up vertically. So yes, I don't know whether this fellow created them to his specifications or whether Barbier made a prototype and then somebody else made more of them. Apparently there were some accessory tools that could be used for creating the tools, all of which could be done by blind people. He had in mind that they could, you know, it could be self-perpetuating. They could carry on and create more of the same as long as they needed it. But he did, out of his own money, pay for hundreds of sets to be given to the student.
Thank you so much for the description of the technology. That's just fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit more about this method of writing that Barbier developed? Because there are commonalities with the Braille system that we recognize today, but it was different. So can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, the book that he wrote in 1815, all 12 of those methods are based on a grid. Well, two grids really, but the idea of a grid. At the time, the French alphabet didn't commonly include the letter W. It occurred in proper names, but it wasn't part of French words. And so it's a 25 letter alphabet, which fits neatly into a grid 5 by 5. You would have the grid, and the cells of the grid were numbered by row and column. So A is column 1, or row 1, column 1. B, C, D, E, you know, that row 1, column 5, all the way down to Z, which was row 5, column 5, which meant that the key to the system was the place of the letter in the grid. So everything had two digits attached to it. A was 1, 1. Z was 5, 5, and everything in between. Those numbers could be replaced by simple symbols, a circle or a square or a triangle or something like that. And a combination of two of them would create a letter. The one he created for blind people was the simplest of all, because the number of the dots simply represented the place in the grid. So the dots were lined up vertically, and if the letter you were trying to represent was in the fourth row and the second column, you would have four vertical dots followed by two vertical dots. Together, those two formed the letter. So it was very easy to do. You just had to count the dots. It didn't involve remembering which symbol represented which number. It was actually numerical itself. So it didn't take long to learn. It was very easy to learn. And you can sort of think about it and think, yes, I can see how you would do that. And if you don't remember where anything is, you can just count on your fingers to find out which two numbers you need to represent any particular letter of the alphabet. There was a second grid, as I mentioned, and that was the sounds of. So here he's getting, this is where he's moving to phonetic spelling. That was a grid of 5 by 6, because he identified 30 sounds in the French language, unique sounds. But the method was the same. So you just, it was the two-part method and the dots and things, but you could spell things phonetically. So you had an option. Everybody says, well, it was all phonetic. Well, no, you could use it for just regular spelling, everything normal that the students had already learned to do, they could do with this system, just using the alphabetical version.
That's so neat that we had built in kind of both options, right? So people had a choice, presumably, as to which one they preferred or felt most convenient to the particular
test.
Really, really creative. So he has these sort of model systems. He's writing about them in this 1815 book that you mentioned. How do these actually get into the Institution Royale des Jeunes Aveugles? Like, what's the process there? And of course, we mentioned that Louis Braille's famously a student there. So what happens once these systems move inside the walls of the school?
Well, as I mentioned, the school was reestablished in about 1816. And Barbier writes to the director, who isn't the least bit interested, and brushes him off. Which is kind of understandable. He's trying to get the school going again. They've already got all these books, with the old method. So a lot of people dump on the previous director for not having seen the potential, but he really did have other fish to fry at that time. But anyway, that director gets fired a few years later in about 1821, and is replaced by a new one. And Barbier knows somebody who's on the Conseil d'administration, which is like the board of directors of the school, who presumably alerts him and says, try again with this guy. He might be more receptive. And he is and he isn't. It's a funny story. And so the new director, his name was Alexandre René Pignet. He's universally thought to be a much better director than the preceding one, and much, much, much nicer person to the students. The other guy had been rather tough on them. So Barbier writes to him, and Pignet does everything he can not to meet Barbier. He loses the first letter. He does respond to the second letter, but he makes appointments and doesn't bother to show up. He keeps Barbier at a distance, but he doesn't. It's not that he's not interested in the ideas, and he does something very smart. He gives the material. So Barbier has obviously sent the tools and some instruction information, and he gives it to one of the senior students. At least I think it's one of the senior students rather than one of the teachers. And says, look, you try it. And if it works, teach it to the other students. Which is really smart. I mean, he thought if it's going to work, then the students have got to be able to teach it to themselves and amongst themselves. And so this student did. I have a theory about who the student was, and he was like Braille. He was a person who went on to later teach at the school. He'd been at the school for quite a long time. He would have been in his late teens at that time. And yes, it worked. It worked, and it could be demonstrated. So. They do a demonstration for the Conseil d'administration, the very simple thing. And they've done this, they do this at different points along the way, but you have two students. One of them is sent out to a different room. While that person is out of the room, the first student take notes that they could give to other students and they could read it. They couldn't do that before. They could read printed books. And they could do a form of writing that could be read by sighted people, but they could finally write something down and read it back to themselves. This is huge. This is absolutely huge. And the students realized it was huge. And even though the method had all the problems of, no punctuation, no mathematical symbols and so forth, I call it a sort of proof of concept. It worked. They show it worked. It was a feasibility test. They could demonstrate it, and it worked. So that was sort of, it really must have landed with quite a crash. Immediately, of course, not just Braille, but all the students think, oh, well, you know, you could do this with it and you could do that with it and you could try this or try that. But they had something and it worked.
One thing that is really standing out to me as you're talking, Philippa, is the ways that Barbier's raised point writing system actually was, it was a highly portable system and improved kind of the mode or the medium of communication between students.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a very particular and special quality of this system.
Yeah, mind you, that's the one thing that in one way, Barbier, because it was so simple, it didn't have didn't meet with the same kind of problems that Braille later met with, because you could learn it very quickly. If you already knew your alphabet, you were away to the races. So they could learn it very quickly, and so could the sighted teachers, because the idea of creating something that only the blind are using, a lot of sighted teachers find that a little threatening. Like, are they writing notes about me in there? But no, the teachers could learn it as easily as the students. Braille, by comparison, takes a while to learn. It really does take days, weeks, even months of study to really master Braille. But this thing is just so simple. So it didn't threaten anybody. Nobody felt, okay, they can use this, but if need be, we can pick up whatever they've written and read it ourselves. It's quite easy to do. It makes a difference.
So I'd love to talk a little bit more about this fated moment that's been told, retold, rehashed many times, the first contact between Barbier and Braille. So when did they first make contact with one another? How did it actually go? And how is the story that you ended up telling that was rooted in the archival sources that you found different from the story that you first encountered about that initial contact?
Well, the letters that Barbier wrote to the school are the ones that are still held in the library of the school. And it took me a while because in that particular library, I was not allowed to either photograph or photocopy anything. I had to transcribe it, which took a long time. But I'm in the middle of transcribing a letter that Barbier wrote to the school in 1833. And, I'm just sort of mechanically doing the words and I think, wait a minute. He's never met Braille. It's 1833 and he's never met Braille. Braille has published his own version 4 years earlier. And Barbier's asking, I hear you have this other version of my system. Would it be okay if I could see a copy of that? And somebody sends it to him. And the very next day he writes to Braille saying, wow, that's amazing. Congratulations. Well done. So they don't meet right away, he doesn't even find out about the system. So at this point, Braille is 24 years old. And the library there has about 10 letters that Barbier wrote to Braille. He wrote ordinary letters. He apologizes for not using Braille's system, but he's kind of getting on. And it's not an easy system to learn. So he writes just ordinary letters to Braille that somebody would have had to read aloud to Braille. Braille writes back to him because Braille knows how to write two-sided people. Braille was capable of writing letters to his own parents, for example, back in Coupfray. So they have a correspondence. They meet several times. There's a third person, a friend of Braille's, who is often part of those meetings. The relationship is extremely friendly. They kind of agree to differ about the whole spelling versus phonetics system. Barbier still thinks it needs to be phonetic, so that everybody can learn it. Braille's moving in a different direction. But they don't seem to, that particular difference of opinion doesn't seem to have harmed anything. They Braille is an adult when they meet. And he's actually halfway through modifying his first version to make the second version of Braille, which is the one we have now.
Thank you so much. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how and why you think the story, really the story of the relationship between Barbier and Braille, when they met, the kind of influence that Barbier had on Braille, how that story came to be so distorted, and what, based on all of the research that you've done, what do you think were some of the motivating factors when you consider the ways that this story has been conveyed? What were some of the, I don't know, narrative appeals of distorting the story in particular ways?
Well, the first distortion is why Barbier came up with this method at all, this idea that he created it for the military. I traced that back to that very first book that I read in 2016 by Pierre-Henri, The Biography of Braille. Pierre-Henri was himself blind. He was a professor at the university, but the materials that Barbier left behind, none of them are accessible to the blind. And he clearly did not see the book written in 1815, had no idea that this one method of writing was, there was a context to it, was part of a whole series of different methods of writing. All he knew was that Barbier had created this form of writing, and he perhaps wondered why. And I'm just gonna read the one sentence that kind of sent everybody off in the wrong direction. This is my own translation from his French. As a former captain of artillery, Barbier had perhaps once felt how useful it could be for officers in the field to be able to write messages in the dark and later read them with their fingers. That's it. He's clearly speculating, saying he might have thought this, it might have crossed his mind. He's not sure that that's what Barbier was doing. He just says, you know, he could have thought that, but he didn't. But everybody's taken that as fact, as if that was exactly what Barbier was doing, and has written about it thereafter. And nobody has bothered to go back and say, well, what exactly was he doing? What was he trying to do, and who was he trying to reach? Because nobody read the book. The other one, the one about the early meeting or early contact between Barbier and Braille when Braille is quite young, comes from Pigné himself. So in the 1850s, Pigné writes a short biography of Braille. By this time, Braille has died. Braille dies in 1852. Barbier died in 1841. So they're both dead. Neither of them can contradict anything he says. So Pigné decides, I'm going to write my version of events. And again, here is the exact words that he wrote. Again, my translation from the French. Louis Braille, like other students, studied the method and with the sagacity that characterized him, indicated to Monsieur Barbier several improvements and resolved certain difficulties with the writing, little problems for which Monsieur Barbier had long sought a solution. Complete fiction, total fiction, didn't happen. They didn't change the writing, sort of certain difficulties with the writing. It's like points, like what, there was no way to change it. You either did use the method and write little points, or you didn't. There wasn't anything that changed about it. It never changed. You notice that Pigné also doesn't actually say they did this in person. He says it could have been a letter. I mean, if in his invention, he doesn't say they actually met, because after all, they didn't. He just says that Braille pointed this out to Barbier. And again, people have rushed in and filled in the story and created this dramatic encounter between the saintly little child and the evil captain, and gone, sort of run with that, because it makes a good story. And don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. And it's a way better story. It's much more dramatic than the real story, which is that they quite liked each other and they met when they were adults. That's not so dramatic.
So these distortions have obviously affected how we think about Barbier. As you just said, he becomes this villainous figure, right? But they also affect how we have come to think about Braille, right? So can you talk us through some of the implications for this distorted story having made its way into the popular imagination?
Yeah. Well, first, the one about creating something for the military, it makes it sound as if Braille takes something that was designed for one purpose and uses it for a different purpose for which it was not originally designed, which again adds sort of luster to its name, but is not in fact what happened. But that's perhaps a minor problem. I think the other one, the story about the little kid and the evil captain, is a little more, changes the story, the narrative, quite a lot. Because what Pinier was trying to do, obviously, is make Braille look even more precocious than he actually was, that he's able to identify all these problems up front and confront the inventor with them. But, and this gets back to why so many stories are...
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode of the Disability History Association's podcast. To listen to the remainder of this episode, you can check out their website, disthist.org. That's disthist.org. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at AvalancheCKUT or CKUT's Spoken Word Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or spokenword@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Herse. That's up next.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. I would love your cop to be inside me. Oh, fuck. Oh, God. I'm really gonna come. I'm really gonna come. Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Can you see how wet I am? Can you see how wet I am? Oh, fuck. Yeah. 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 Oh, fuck.
It's time for Audio Smith. It's time for Audio Smith. Smith, 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 Smith.
A queer, feminist, trans positive radio show about fucking in all its forms.
Five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content.
So turn the volume all the way up.
Oh, that was so hot. I'm gonna pee for you now. Are you ready? Yeah, you wanna watch me pee? Oh, yeah, I'm gonna pee. Yeah.
I think I like.